On November 15, 2014, Leslie Feinberg died after a long siege of Lyme disease and other tick-borne illnesses. As a writer and orator, Feinberg powerfully advocated for what we now call intersectionalism, the unified struggle of all oppressed classes and identities.
Out of respect and solidarity for disabled activists who are here, rather than ask people to stand, I'm going to ask you to raise your hands. Raise your hand, please, if you face oppression as a woman. Raise your hand, please, if you face oppression because you are transsexual, transgender, intersex, lesbian, gay, or bisexual. If you're a partner, not just related to oppression, but living with it as queer family, please raise your hand. If you face discrimination for femininity, whether female or male, please raise your hand. If you are oppressed because of your nationality, your ethnicity, your religion, or your immigration status, and you feel comfortable on that last one to raise your hand, please do. If you face inaccessibility in society based on age discrimination, whether youth or elder, please raise your hand. Now, if you've raised your hand more than once, please raise your hand. I believe that the movement for women's liberation will be more powerful as we explore more deeply the connections between all of us who raised our hands tonight. And together with all of those who are listening to these broadcasts, who we know would be raising their hands if they were here, and with those who are struggling around the world, from Iraq to Haiti, from Palestine to Venezuela.
There's a river of birds in migration, a nation of women with wings. There's
Welcome to Wings, a series of news and current affairs programs by and about women around the world, produced and distributed by the Women's International News Gathering Service.
Today on Wings, excerpts from Leslie Feinberg's 2006 address to the Women's Studies Department at Simon Fraser University on their 30th anniversary. She was introduced by Dr. Helen Leung.
It is such an honor for me to be introducing Leslie Feinberg. I still remember the poster in a little bookstore in Madison, Wisconsin, announcing the publication of Stonebridge Blues. At that time, in 1993, the relation between feminist, queer, transgender, and leftist communities was fraught with unspoken tension. It was tough for anyone, let alone someone young and of color, to navigate through the thicket of prejudice and border wars. Stonebridge Blues showed me a moving vision of how to survive far tougher manifestations of those wars with one's courage intact. And it was also a powerful, pitch-perfect, and beautifully structured novel. The book was later translated into German, Dutch, and to my absolute delight, Chinese. Leslie followed the success of Stonebridge Blues with Transgender Warriors, making history from Joan of Arc to Dennis Rodman. In 1998, Leslie published Trans Liberation Beyond Pink and Blue, a collection of stirring speeches that demonstrate the essential connection between the transgender movement and all social movements for equality. Hot off the press this month is the long, long-awaited new novel, Drag King Dreams, which is set in post-9/11 New York and picks up many of the themes left off in Stonebridge Blues. Besides writing, Leslie's activism also reflects a passionate commitment to coalition building. For over 25 years, Leslie has worked as a trade unionist and anti-racist, defended Native American treaty rights and the freedom of political prisoners in the U.S., while tirelessly speaking out on issues of social justice all over the world. So please join me in a very warm welcome for Leslie.
Bonsoir. Ni hao ma. Konnichiwa. I thank you for welcoming me here. I've been very ill since last summer. This is the first time I've been out of my house traveling. Yay. Thank you. While it's not life-threatening, something I didn't know last summer, it is a challenge for me physically to stand up here and speak. It's also a big thing for me to get to come to Canada. I grew up in Buffalo. I could have walked across the so-called Peace Bridge. It was so close. And for the old gay community, which I don't just mean those of us who are getting hoary-headed here, but the pre-Stonewall community, the blue-collar, gay, lesbian, drag communities, we were sororal communities with those from St. Catharines and Toronto and spent a great deal of our time in Canada. It was only during the Vietnam War when my gender queerness made crossing the bridge impossible, because the first thing I would be asked is, where's your draft card? While there is no universal military draft in the U.S. at this point, just an economic draft and extended tours that get extended and extended, my travel here across this border and returning home tomorrow through immigration makes me a criminal. I am a felon because this passport is issued to me as male and I am female-bodied. I can talk more with you during the discussion about why, but I want to say to you that if I am detained in that no man's land of U.S. customs, then I ask you to help me make a struggle out of this, because I say to the U.S. government, tell me why, on a passport that has the most sophisticated form of identification possible, a recent photo, I have to check off an either-or box and be virtually strip searched by customs just to come here and connect with you. I live in Jersey City on the East Coast in the U.S. I don't use America because everyone in this hemisphere is of the Americas. And tonight I want to focus on a couple of the historical lessons that we've had in the women's struggles in the belly of the beast, a beast making war domestically and carrying it around the world. My job is to bring the war home, to deepen understanding that my enemy is not in Baghdad or Gaza, Havana or Tehran, Damascus or Pyongyang or Caracas. It's in Washington, on Capitol Hill, and on Wall Street. And so it means a great deal to me here to be able to connect with you all about deepening our theoretical understanding of women's oppression and what it will take for liberation. Because if theory is abstracted, if it is not a distillation of experience, then it ceases to become a guide for action. The experience in the U.S. of the struggle for women's liberation, of course, predates what we call second-wave feminism. There are many who have explored, perhaps not enough in the U.S., but have explored the relationship between the 19th century women's rights movement and the struggle to abolish the enslavement of African peoples. It was one of the greatest coalitions, if not the greatest, to date in the country of what is now the United States. I believe we also need to explore the trans issues and gay issues that were part of that movement. To go back and restudy Sojourner Truth's challenge in her Ain't I a Woman speech, where she challenged white supremacy and the class bias of the social definition of what it meant to be a true woman, true womanhood. Sojourner Truth, who stood 6 feet tall, whose voice was described as rolling thunder, whose muscles rippled from a lifetime of enforced enslaved labor. Sojourner Truth, who was forced to strip to the waist by white men who demanded to know if she was a man in women's clothing. In Seneca Falls, the convention in 1848, Frederick Douglass, the great orator, the great abolitionist, and one of the greatest advocates for women's rights that we have seen yet in the United States, was one of 31 men who attended that convention. He stood up and said something there that we could march under as a banner today. He said from the podium that our doctrine is that right is of no sex. Frederick Douglass, the other 30 men at that convention, and any man who stood up for women's rights were gay baited and trans baited and intersexual baited. He was called a hermaphrodite, an Aunt Nancy's man, a women's rights man. Now that curse has lost its sting. Now if somebody said, what are you, a women's rights man? It's like, what? But at the time, it was a serious slur meant to emasculate a man who was only a few years out of enslavement himself. And Frederick Douglass demonstrated how to stand up to that kind of baiting. He came out publicly again and again, and he said, I am proud to be known as a women's rights man. And before his death, when he spoke to another conference of women, if I might be allowed to paraphrase, he said, when I ran away from slavery, escaped from slavery, it was for myself. When I advocated emancipation, it was for my people. But when I stood up for women's rights, the question of self was out of the question. And in doing so, I found a little nobility in the act. I believe that's the kind of nobility, the only kind of nobility, to which we should aspire, to be the best fighters against each other's oppression. After the Civil War, when the Democratic and Republican parties tried to tear asunder this powerful coalition by pitting the rights of black men to vote against the rights of white women to vote, Douglass appealed that lynch law was the law of the land. He appealed to white women to support the right of black men to vote and said he would work as hard as he could to bring about the vote for white women as well. It was the white women who stood with African American liberation who should be on the programming for March Women's History Month, and who should be on the coins instead of those like Susan B. Anthony who succumbed to white supremacy in order to defend the right of white women to vote against the right of black men to vote. And when the export of the southern plantations was sent to Cuba and the Philippines and Hawaii, as the expansion of capital, the beginning of this globalization under the cry of free trade, Teddy Roosevelt would exclaim that without war, we will become a nation of effeminate men. The trans baiting that became the birth of Rambo. In Germany in the late 19th and early 20th century, there was a powerful rising movement for gay and trans and lesbian liberation, and it connected with the rise of a women's rights movement as well. And it was a time when there was a powerful workers' movement with socialist leadership, and workers were electing socialists to parliament, and everyone knew World War I was coming. It wasn't a surprise. It was like when the U.S. media was saying, oh, you know, the invasion of Iraq is going to be in February, now the 15th, now the 20th. No, it's going to be March. But when the war began, those who were in parliament caved in and voted for the war credits, and so did many who were the leadership of the German homosexual emancipation movement. The notable exceptions were Rosa Luxemburg and Karl Liebknecht. And it derailed the movement. You know, you could almost imagine the leaders saying, well, gee, it's not really a gay issue, you know. And we're making such headway with the population, and we don't want to appear to be unpatriotic, you know. Can't we just go along with this war? Can't we just sit it out? Well, no, of course not. Because it meant that patriotism, social chauvinism, racism, jingoism began to roll like tank treads over the population. Those who were the most reactionary began to sit taller in the saddle, and those who were the most progressive or revolutionary began to be more isolated and pushed aside. War is a defining moment for any movement. If we can't stand up to a racist colonial war for empire, then what will our movements be able to stand up for? It wasn't until the 1917 Russian Revolution, which within weeks abolished the anti-homosexual laws and extended political and economic and social rights for women, that a new wind began to fill the sails of the movement in Germany as well with new leadership. And in November 1918, during the brief German Revolution, while the bullets were still whizzing overhead, the young revolution gave one of its first gifts to the German homosexual emancipation movement. Prince Hatzfeld's seized mansion, which was handed over to be the new archives of the sexual liberation movement and became maybe what we could call one of the first lesbian, gay, and trans community centers. And I know I'm leaving out bisexual, but it's because I specifically cannot find that inclusion, but it doesn't mean it did not exist, and I'm still looking. In the U.S., there are many who have heard, of course, about second wave feminism. You may think that all women, and particularly young women, have, but that's not true. If they have heard about it, they've heard the Rush Limbaugh attack on feminism as feminazis. Vicious. They've heard that they were the gender police. Or George Bush Sr.'s ghostwriter's formulation about political correctness, which the right wing has embraced, saying, why can't we just be so openly racist and male chauvinist pigs and always have to be looking over our shoulder nowadays? Why do we have to be so politically correct? Some have heard about the homophile movement at the height of McCarthyism in the 1950s in the U.S. And if you just read about the homophile movement, you would think, how did it stand up to McCarthyism? How did it happen in the middle of what was the most reactionary period in U.S. history towards lesbians and gay men? A specific campaign in which not only anti-communist red baiting, but lavender menace gay baiting and mass purges from employment were at a frenzy. They looked to the establishment, to the experts, to say, tell us how to just fit in. Tell us how to adjust to oppression. Tell us how not to stand out. They had dress codes. They divorced themselves, quite literally, from the bar crowd, from those who were too butch if they were female and too femme if they were male. How did they organize? In the middle of the 1950s, it was a time of a raging witch hunt because the U.S. rulers were enraged about having so-called lost China to a revolution. And the Korean War was underway. And if you spoke out about anything progressive, you could expect to find your name and address in the newspaper, be hounded, lose your job, have to move, have to go underground. It was a time after the war, the burgeoning war industry, which had drawn more women and more African Americans into big industry. And now suddenly Rosie the Riveter was being sent home where father knew best. But what has been left like a gap in social memory because of the excising of the official histories of that period is the tumultuous and militant struggles that were going on that objectively lifted up even the most moderate demands. For example, how many people here know that between 1950 and 1953, the first gay organizing on a political basis publicly based on the West Coast was led by communist gays? One hand, two and three, four, out of all the people who are here. And that they went out to the gay beaches on the West Coast and got petitions signed to support the Korean people against the Pentagon war. And that they tried to link up the struggle in solidarity with African Americans, with Latinos, and the struggle against anti-Semitism. Daughters of Bilitis, the first national political lesbian rights organization, certainly not the first organizing of lesbians. No voices could have been lifted sweeter or clearer than those of the Harlem Renaissance. And the buffet parties and the rent parties were just as much political organizing and economic organizing. But this was on a national basis. It was largely white women, white collar, professional, middle class for the most part. How did they form in 1955? What gave these lesbians the idea in San Francisco that this was just the right political moment in history to sit down and organize? Well, here's another whiteout, whitewash from the official histories. The decade of militant red feminism from 1946 to the mid-50s, in which communist women, black and white, were out organizing, particularly in strength, on the West Coast in California. And they also helped lay a theoretical basis for the relationship of women's oppression to racism and to class oppression, and to fight for an understanding within the left movement that women's oppression is a critical frontline battle in the class war. And in 1955, that was the year that the civil rights movement accelerated. In the summer of 1955, before the Daughters of Bilitis formed, you could see black women, particularly working class women, in the leadership of a movement that was inspiring the downtrodden everywhere in the U.S. and around the world. That was the summer that 14-year-old Emmett Till was dragged from the bed where he was visiting in Mississippi and lynched, the third lynching of an African-American male in the U.S. that year alone. His mother, Mamie Till Mobley, made a courageous decision in Chicago. She demanded that the casket be opened for his funeral. And 50,000 people lined the streets of Chicago to view his body, which was almost unrecognizable because of the mutilation by white supremacists. 100 days later, seamstress Rosa Parks refused to surrender her seat on a municipal bus in Birmingham to a white man who demanded it. She later told a reporter, "I kept thinking about Emmett Till. I couldn't get the photos out of my mind." After a 381-day bus boycott, it was like it lit the tinder of all the anti-lynching and all the anti-racist, anti-Jim Crow segregation organizing that was going on. After 381 days in which 40,000 African Americans refused to take the bus and walk to work, that hard-won battle just sent shockwaves through the country in terms of inspiring people that oppression could be fought. Lesbians and gay men of all nationalities, including whites, were part of the civil rights movement, supporting not just an end to racist apartheid, to segregation, but the aspirations and the ongoing struggle for national liberation because the U.S. is like a prison house of nations. It's like domestic colonies, internal colonies under police occupation. And when the FBI tried to bust up the movement, to fracture the solidarity and break it up, they didn't just use red baiting, they used gay baiting. When I said that the homophile movement did not defend those of us who were in the bars, did not want to be associated with those of us in the bars, I'm not just criticizing like a Monday morning quarterback. It's the reason that Stonewall exploded. Those from below were nose to nose with the state. We knew at any moment in the bars that the cops could come through the door at any time. And just to get a job, just to get an apartment, just to use the toilet in public, just to walk down the street was a battle. It was no accident that Stonewall exploded from those who were the most oppressed. Stonewall was mostly fueled, that uprising, by those youth who lived in the little vest pocket park across the street, who could not afford to get into the bar with those watered-down, expensive drinks. They were black youth, Latina youth, white youth. They were homeless. Many were sex workers. They pooled their money just to be able to have one hotel room that they could share. And when the police raided that night and the government agents were there demanding the draft cards of everyone and dunking the heads of the drag queens into buckets of water and smearing the makeup on their faces and mocking them as limp-wristed sissies and reminding them that the sentence would be carried out that night in the backseat of a police cruiser or on the cold cement floor of a precinct cell, those who were being rounded up struggled and fought back. And so did the youth in the street. And they surrounded the police and they began to throw their precious pocket change and pebbles and bottle caps and anything they could find. And the police began to retreat, not just because of a hail of tiny projectiles, but the youth that night taught the police that a stiletto high heel in the hands of an enraged transgender youth is a formidable weapon against police brutality.
Leslie Feinberg, author of Stone Butch Blues, Drag King Dreams, and Transgender Warriors. Next week on Wings, the stunning conclusion of Feinberg's address to the Women's Studies Department of Simon Fraser University. Feinberg died November 15, 2014. This talk was recorded and edited by Wendy Pretty, who also composed and performed the musical interludes. For more information and to hear Wings programs again, email wings@wings.org. And please check our daily news feed at facebook.com/wingsradio. Wings thanks all our supporters, including WORT-FM in Madison, Wisconsin, your local community radio station, Suzette Cullen, and Genevieve Vaughn, editor of the book Women and the Gift Economy. The Wings sound logo is from Libana's album, A Circle is Cast. I'm Frieda Worden. This is the Women's International News Gathering Service.